This week's episode is brought to you by Oracle NetSuite. Oracle NetSuite, I think, solves a really important problem that a lot of startups, business owners, executives face, which is how do you get the information that you need instantly all in one place? Before we upgraded to Oracle NetSuite at my last startup, it used to take us a lot of time to pull the information reports that we needed for our quarterly investment meeting, or the report that we wanted to send to both internal employees as well as stakeholders and shareholders at the end of the month. Upgrade to Oracle NetSuite today so you can get the visibility and control you need over your financials, HR, inventory, and everything you need in one place that you can access instantly. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/scale. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/scale. That is netsuite.com/scale.
All right, cool. Welcome back to another episode of Uncharted and Eclectic. Really excited to have Stephen Boone join us today from the team over at Twilio. Stephen, welcome to the podcast and thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Awesome. So typically we ask about folks' upbringing and kind of where they're from and a little bit of context and story on their background, but I'm actually going to get kind of pretty specific right off the bat. You spent some years as a sake maker. As in the Japanese adult beverage. And actually, I don't even know that it is necessarily of Japanese origin. I just associate it with that. So maybe could you tell us just a little bit about that stage of the journey? And then I think we'll work our way into the wonderful world of SaaS after that.
Sure. Yes. The life story up until sake making, it all started with a man and a woman. We'll start a little bit later. But look, I was 17 when I went to college. I grew up in a small town in Oregon. I went to the East Coast and I was young. And I remember being very unhappy right off the bat, like in the first semester. And I thought to myself, okay, so I'm not happy. I don't know what I want to do when I grow up. And this is going to cost $50,000 a year. And I'm going to be in a lot of debt. And I think, it probably costs twice as much nowadays. But to me, and my little lizard brain back then, I was like, this is not a good deal for me. So I left college after a semester. I dropped out. I didn't tell my parents until I'd pretty much already made the decision and it was a week or two away. As I look back, I know how blessed I was to be able to make that decision and to know that I had a very soft place to land. And my parents, very rightfully so, were like, hey, you need to work if you're not going to go to college. You need to work and you should probably figure out what you want to do, long-term. And knowing that I didn't really have any true north on the compass at that point, I think part of me was like, I'm going to take a really hard job. And one of the harder jobs you can take is to be on a bottling line. I lived in a place that had great water, which is one of the things that makes great sake. And so I started working sanitation on the bottling line and on the bottling line at a place called Sake One. They make Momokawa. It's a sister company to a big company in Japan. It was, I think, eventually bought by Hakistura, which is one of the biggest ones. But I got to tell you, it was brutal work. So making sake is actually a little more similar. It's often compared to wine. It's actually a little more similar to beer. So you get, there's a special yeast called koji. You mill rice down just like the comparables with beer. You add the yeast to it, you eventually get alcohol. And it's just really dirty. The beverage is not dirty, don't get me wrong, but like the process is very difficult. And we were not making hundreds of thousands of cases a day or anything. So a lot of the processes were still super manual. I have bleach burns on my arms still. Working sanitation was when I learned that bleach actually comes in a syrup that you take about a thimbleful of and then a gallon of water to make regular bleach. And you do not want to get that syrup on yourself. But I did that for about a year. You probably don't want the whole life story, but afterwards, raised enough money to go do the who knows what I want to do next thing, which is like go spend 2 months in Brazil backpacking around. Eventually went back to college and, that's the rest of the story. But working on a bottling line will teach you how tough it is to imagine a career without all of the opportunities that so many of us, and my guess is many people listening to the podcast, have. And it definitely was something where I met amazing people, got a lot of respect for the craft, but also the difficulty of, you know, really tough manual labor jobs. And, you know, it was definitely enough to tell me I should probably go back to school too.
Awesome. I appreciate the takeaways. And so you go back, study at it looks like the University of Oregon, where I'm also an alumni. So go Ducks. And then make your way down to Silicon Valley. Tell us about the decision to move to the Bay. What drew you there, and kind of like what got your start coming out of Oregon?
Sure. So yeah, go Ducks. My wife was always in tech, by the way. So she's been at big companies and small companies and in demand gen mainly. And it was only a matter of time before we moved to the Bay Area, we had to. And I actually decided to go to law school at Cal when we moved down here. But so the lizard brain again says, you know, you scored pretty well on this test that gets you into law school. And I hear that lawyers make pretty good money. You don't know anything about the legal profession, but yeah, sure. Go to law school, graduate, you know, take the patent bar and go to a big firm or something like that. And about a semester into law school down here at Cal, I was speaking to my peers who were all just awesome people. And they all had great stories for wanting to be at law school. None of their stories were, I did okay on the LSAT, by the way. They were, I'm super passionate about the environment, or I worked in a refugee camp for 3 years, or I did Teach for America. You know, this is Berkeley as well. There were also some folks who were like, yeah, I did, you know, consulting or investment banking for a couple of years, or was a paralegal and I want to go into a big firm. But everyone seemed to understand why they were there. And I did not know what I wanted to be when I grew up, which is probably like, essentially, you shouldn't go to a really expensive trade school if you don't know what you want to do. The days of that costing $1,000 a year are gone. So I made a decision to take a leave of absence at the end of the first semester. I actually at the time had the intention to come back. Cal was really cool. So you can keep your scholarship. You can come back anytime in 7 years and finish up. And I really looked at tech jobs, one, because my wife was doing it, two, because everybody, you know, around in Silicon Valley that I could network with has ins at tech companies. And you can kind of go get entry-level tech jobs, especially selling roles, without any marketable skills, right? Which is essentially what I had. So I took an SDR gig at a Series B or C at the time, 100-ish person company called Bloomreach, which sold web content management and search engine software. And boy, was that hard. I don't know exactly, but I think that the people I'm on the call with also started as SDRs, right? Probably half of Silicon Valley did. But I got to tell you, I fell in love with tech. I had a wonderful ride at that company. I could not have been more lucky, because like most people, what did I really have to evaluate the company with at that time, right? You just want to get a job. You hope the company is well-founded, you know, with good investors, which it was, but I didn't know anything about tech. But I just really liked the people. And I had about a 5-year run there, which I'm more than happy to answer any questions about, but progressive experience in a bunch of different roles under awesome people.
Steven, the story resonates in a lot of different ways. And if somebody is at a crossroad today, what advice would you have for them?
The thing that I would tell people, you know, judging by the name of this podcast, is people who may be at crossroads or, you know that there's no clear path in life. I still, the statement about, I don't know what I want to do when I grow up still rings true for me. I've really lived by this mantra and would go back and do everything the same, which is nothing is permanent. You know, the hardest choices I ever made in my life were dropping out of college and then dropping out of law school. And both of those have been incredible for me. I mean, look, even leaving Berkeley, I worked with some of the people I went to law school with afterwards in other companies. I'm friends with many of them and they will be lifelong friends. But all of those things made me who I am. And you can leave. Like, I think the hardest thing about hard choices is it's not that there's some impossible wall blocking your ability to like to make the tough choice and to quit the job or to take the new job or to move across the country or to whatever. It's really fear about what other people will think about you. And having those two big moments pretty early in my life, getting over them and realizing like, no one's going to remember the one time that you dropped out of school 10 years from now. No one really cares. The people who do care about you just want you to be happy has really made me make a lot of other tough choices in my life. And so I would say, you know, was my gut quote wrong a couple of times? Yeah. But the most empowering thing is knowing that you can just correct that and you can correct it really, really fast. The tactical retreat is like, this isn't working out pretty quick. I'm going to go try something else. And living without that fear, I think has been really, really good for me. And I hope other people can do that as well.
And Steve, so that's a great call out. And I think there's probably plenty of people who are going to tune in and think about, or on the cusp of thinking about making a change, you know, whether it's a life change, a career change. I also think that this year in 2020 has forced a lot of people to look at their lives and make decisions for themselves and for their families and for their loved ones. And I guess my question for you is, you know, I think we've all had some element of, and I love that term tactical retreat, some element of tactically retreating from something in your life that you were, you know, committed to, but maybe turned out to be something else. And in my experience, the first retreat's the hardest. And as do you think you can build that muscle over time? Like does each kind of tactical retreat get easier? And would you say that it could even become like a strength over time?
Yeah. I mean, look, the strength to know that the current strategy you're employing is not working and to change course is absolutely one that I think we should all have in business. Is the first one the hardest? Yeah. I mean, it probably depends on, you know, what's the enormity of the decision at hand. But, you know, anytime I'm thinking about a change now, I just ask myself, you know, if I make this choice, is even the thing I'm undoing undoable again? The answer is almost always yes, by the way, if you don't burn bridges, which is one of the keys to the tactical retreat, I would say. Will I be able to feed myself? Will I be able to feed, you know, and support the people around me if those are a piece of your life? Will I end up happier in a more sustainable, you know, way of operating? And if all of those things are true, like what do you really have to lose? On a whim, go try something else, you know. Sit down and think about the thing that you're about to go embark on. But the weighting of those things in all of the choices I made always ended up being okay. And I think like, listen to yourself, do a little bit of the mental math, but then yeah, life is not very long. So go make the choice. Sure.
I like it. A good reminder for folks listening. So I want to switch gears a little bit here, and I kind of want to talk about your leadership style, because I've talked to some folks, Steven. We worked together a little bit when you were at Atrium and have stayed in touch since. And one of the like consistent patterns of feedback that I heard from folks that either worked for you or kind of worked like in your orbit or around you was this sense of urgency. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this because I've always had a little bit of trouble like balancing, you know, how do you find this balance between like consistent urgency in everything you do and what you expect of the people around you, as well as like patience as a leader? There's some things that require one or the other or both. Can you maybe tell us like how you think about that and where you think this sense of urgency comes from?
Yeah. Wow, that's a good question. I don't know if people around me saying that I have a sense of urgency is a knock or not. But look, I don't know if urgency and patience are the two ends of one spectrum would be the first response, which is that, you know, urgency or extreme urgency is like, it's not about everything in your life has to happen right now and everything is urgent. I think what it is it's about ruthless prioritization, right? So look, to a lot of people in a company, service tickets backing up are not something extremely urgent. to a company submitting a service ticket because some business critical solution that they bought from you is down and they literally can't run their business and their livelihood, that is extremely urgent to them. So I would ruthlessly prioritize that as a business. That one conversation that someone who works for you wants to have about their performance review or their comp or not understanding their goals or a relationship that they have in the business or externally that went sideways. Maybe that isn't at the top of your list because there's a million other things going on, but it is extremely important to them. It's probably the most urgent thing to them. And so I think my sense of urgency comes from like trying to be empathetic to how urgent the things for everybody else are. And so maybe that means I end up prioritizing too much and I don't live by my own mantra and I don't ruthlessly prioritize, but like the things that we do in business, they really matter to all of the people around you, to the customers that you serve, to the people who work for you. And so I think you can be extremely urgent about, live your life that way and do it in a way that's actually relatively empathetic, and allows you to be patient for the things that you can be patient for. I struggle, by the way, Robbie, to answer your question, which is like, I want to do, I want to get it all done. Like I hate going to sleep with a to-do list. But what I have learned is, the same way other people may say, if you didn't need to respond to that email in 4 days, it's probably not all that important, or they would email you again or something like that, is to figure out like just what's below the line. We probably spend more than half of our day doing things that are not important for that day. So how do we spend our entire day doing the things that actually need to get done and matter to people if they get done that day? That's kind of how I think about the extreme sense of urgency.
And as you talk, I just sense the empathy that you've had to continuously go through and put yourself in the other person's shoes and kind of come up with the trade-offs. And one of the things as you talk about, I'm like this, I think Stephen comes from a place of like reflection, and where I would love to go is your experience at Atrium, right? Atrium, I think, was trying to solve a super critical problem. Even like 2 days ago, there was a tweet like that the legal space just need to turn upside down and get innovative just because they charge so much. And I'm not saying that's what in any way Atrium was trying to solve, but the question I'd love to ask from that experience and that growth, period of growth where you guys scaled really, really quickly, looking back, what were some of the biggest takeaways and learnings for you?
I was at Atrium almost 2 years. Atrium, for those who don't know or are listening, by the way, was a pretty high profile startup that grew very fast and fizzled out rather quickly as well. Took on tons and tons of money, Mark Andreessen joined as a board observer. We raised $70 million in a couple years on, less than a couple million in revenue, and scaled that thing to about $25 million in ARR very quickly. From the outside, it is probably a pretty big objective failure to raise that much money. And by the way, it has since shut down. I joined the seed stage. It had, 60, 70 people at the time, which is pretty big for a seed stage business. We had done a party round from 100 different investors, some pretty famous names. And I inherited I think it was a team of two salespeople, one marketer, and we grew it wildly fast. I think by the time I ended up leaving Atrium, which was before it shut down, the team was about 35, maybe 15 account executives, half that in SDRs and the rest in marketing, BD, and partnerships on the team I was running. And God, I learned a lot. I mean, I learned that no amount of talent is going to solve all of the woes of a startup. Like you have to be passionate for the problem. I think we were cognizant of all of the issues in the legal space. And, I went to law school, I dropped out. Some of the people I went to law school with were early attorneys at Atrium trying to solve this, this basically issue in the legal space, which is you charge a lot of money per hour. So there is no incentive to innovate or to figure out how to reduce the amount of time that you spend on tasks. So how could we automate that with software? How could we sell legal services at a flat rate to folks so that there was an incentive for our business to innovate? we had all of the people who could have known how to solve the problem, but I don't know if we clicked as a team to solve the problem. And I think especially at the executive level that I was at, I don't think any of us like woke up each day and thought, this is what I'm going to solve. In fact, I think a lot of us woke up each day saying like, wow, this could be a really successful company. This is a good idea. And that was a failure. I think we should have brought more passion in early. And I think we should have listened to the people who had the passion. I think that we just wanted to grow really fast too. I think we got caught up in the same thing that a lot of startups do, which is if you can raise more money, then that's probably good, right? Raising $10 million is good. So raising $20 million must be great. And raising $40 million must be amazing. I can tell you that raising that money comes with expectations. I think when we raised this monster, we called it a B round, but it was an A and a B at the same time. I don't know how you skip the A round, but we did it. And, you know, if we had raised $7 million and said, we're really going to figure this thing out and not scale it dramatically, I think there would have been a lot better shot at Atrium being successful and building a product that really delivered on what we wanted it to. So I learned patience through that. But look, be passionate about the thing that you're building. Take the time to nail it before you scale it. That's how you're going to be successful. But I do think there's a big hole in the market. People are tweeting about it, as you said. And I think somebody needs to go solve legal, by the way. That is a massively inefficient market that is about 1% of GDP. So it's not small. And if somebody figures it out, that's great. But it wasn't us. And it almost clearly shouldn't have been us, right? A guy who dropped out of law school, some really smart executives from Facebook and other companies, the guy who founded Twitch, like, sure, people on that team had raised money before.
I can relate to what you're saying, Stephen, about the expectations that come from raising a lot of money. I wasn't in an executive role during my time at Zenefits, but we took on a similar sort of amount of capital in a really short, condensed time frame. And the company's still around, but certainly the moonshot expectations that come with the amount of capital that we raised weren't necessarily met. But interesting to hear the takeaways. And I wonder, it'll be interesting to see if anybody from that Atrium like lineage or tree goes on to solve legal. It'll be interesting to see kind of what the alumni do. I feel like not enough time has passed to see kind of what'll come next, but certainly there was a pretty incredibly talented team there. So thanks for opening up and sharing that. So the part that I really wanted to make sure we spend a little time on today was just your experience inside of Twilio. Twilio, I think, is one of the coolest SaaS companies in the world. One of the kind of most recent generations of SaaS, you know, decacorns, I guess we can call them, that evolved from a self-serve driven model to B2B sales. I think a lot of CEOs who have done this successfully, like Slack and others, have kind of famously been against having sales teams. But now when you look at Twilio, they've got this really big, like, world-class sales engine. You're on the front lines working directly with the CRO of the company every day. Would love to just kind of ask if we could get an inside look on what it's like to kind of help be a part of building up this muscle of going from more of a self-serve driven business to a kind of a B2B sales motion.
Absolutely. It's a great question. And Twilio is an incredible company. I feel very, very lucky to be here. My role, as you kind of alluded to, is I'm the chief of staff to the CRO. It's a really interesting time in the business because you're right. So Twilio, you know, I wasn't there years ago when it IPO'd, but I think the sales team was probably, you know, low double digits at the time. And something they hadn't really nailed at that point. So most of the business came in through developer self-serve. Someone signed up with an account, put their credit card in, and off to the races, right? You were building, you were using communications APIs to communicate with your customers. And I think the most impressive thing to me about Twilio that really made me want to join were two things. One, that the leadership at Twilio said, there's probably a better path to distribution, that you can both service these developers and be, you know, be evangelists for their needs and build them great product. And you can service the needs of the enterprise and you can build a sales engine on top of that. with a profile of rep that, you know, can come from other big SaaS companies and end up being really successful at Twilio, which I certainly do not think was the case years ago. And I think that it came from a place of realizing that you don't have to like give up the things that made your company great in order to build sales on top of that, which is, I think, what a lot of folks mean when they run a developer self-serve business. And then it's like, we don't want salespeople because it's the antithesis of what we do. Like, we wouldn't be servicing our customer, we'd be selling to them. And I don't think that's true. I think a lot of enterprises want to buy from a salesperson. I think that a lot of large enterprises need access to Twilio's tools, but don't have the resources to go build them internally nimbly, right? That's why there's this big systems integrator, you know, space out there, right? It's to deploy systems at scale. And so we brought in the right talent way before me to be able to go scale the sales function. And when I was looking at the business earlier this year, what impressed me most is that from a market opportunity perspective, it's still pretty nascent. So you have this, you know, huge business that's wildly successful. Then you start building the sales engine on top of it. And I remember speaking to the CRO who I work for. And as I ask questions, I'm like, you know, hey, my biggest fear about coming to this place is I just don't know how to operate at a business of this scale. And I was excited, not afraid, when I learned that a lot of the systems, tools, and processes on the sales team had been really successful, but were still pretty early, which just read as opportunity to me. It meant, oh my gosh, this thing could be even 10 times better and bigger than it is already. And that was exactly what I wanted, by the way. When I left Atrium, I said, I'm going to go, there's only a couple companies like this, but I'm going to go to a company that's probably north of $1 billion in revenue. And I still think can grow 10X in 5 years. Like, that level of growth is still possible. And, you know, you end up with like 5 or 6 companies on your hands. And I feel so blessed to be at one of them that I think fits the bill.
As you talk, I can sense the pride as well as opportunity that you guys have, and especially with the acquisitions. And the thing I love about Twilio, just at least from the outsider, I think there's a lot of companies as they scale, once they start with the developer, I still remember like the little billboard that they had on the 101 where you meet like 280 and 101 in San Francisco and said, ask your developer. As they scale, they kind of miss out on that like developer first mentality. But Twilio to this day, I think it's stayed and it's remained that way. And you guys have just, you've done such an amazing job making sure when employee number 2000 joins, like they still believe in that mission and kind of how you guys go to market. Steven, this has been such an awesome episode. And as you've talked, I'm just sitting there like kind of listening and tuning in. And like, you've kind of challenged me to reflect on some of the things I do day to day. One of the questions we love ending every episode with, looking back, whether you're at Oregon or at Cal, what would the wiser older Steven tell your younger self? Like, what is that one thing that you wish, if you could go back in time, you have an opportunity to share with yourself?
Sure. That is a good question. I'm pushing you to be wise beyond my years. You know, at those ages, just there's no predefined path. I think we hit on that a lot earlier in the episode. You know, from that age until even now, the thing that I try to tell myself and I every day, and I have not mastered this yet, but I assume many people on listening to this have the issue, is you are not an imposter, is what I would say to myself. Like, it is okay to make mistakes. Nothing is permanent. No one remembers the one word that you botched in the presentation or the sentence, or that you couldn't share your screen correctly, or that you said something dumb in front of an executive because you were trying, by the way, that shows initiative. And I think I've probably wasted a lot of emotional calories throughout my life, just worrying about what other people thought of me and that it would all fall apart tomorrow or the next day or the next week or something. I think I've gotten a little bit better, and there's still a lot of work to go on that journey. But do not spend those emotional calories worrying about things that you can't really impact and really don't matter. Because if you're talented enough to be worrying about that all the time, imagine how much better you would be if you could just focus all of that energy towards whatever the goal is. And I think that's even more important now than ever. It's been a tough year for all of us, but that's what I'm trying to tell myself. And I wish I could go have that conversation with myself 10 years ago.
Yeah, well said. And thanks for sharing that, Stephen. It reminds me of something that one of our past guests, Nicole Allen, shared a few weeks ago about imposter syndrome. So I think it's something that a lot of people deal with. And it's cool to see people having a ton of success in their life that are willing to still admit that that's something that they cope with and work on and get better at every day. So listen, Stephen, this has been so fun. We thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your journey and being open and vulnerable and sharing some of the lessons and learnings and takeaways and mistakes and things you've picked up over the years. If folks want to connect with you or get in touch, I guess one, would you be open to that? And two, what's a good way for folks to get in touch?
Of course is the answer. LinkedIn, I try to respond to every message that isn't a sales message. I have a pretty high batting average. Sometimes I miss them, but please reach out to me on LinkedIn. You can also email me. I'm more than happy to respond to emails. It's a weird one. So, well, there's just periods. StephenC.H.Boone@gmail.
I like it. Awesome. Well, Stephen, thanks for coming on and good luck closing out the year and happy holidays. And we'll hope to have you back on in a couple years when you guys have 10x'd the revenue that you guys are at today with Twilio.
I hope so.
This week's episode is brought to you by Oracle NetSuite. Oracle NetSuite, I think, solves a really important problem that a lot of startups, business owners, executives face, which is how do you get the information that you need instantly all in one place? Before we upgraded to Oracle NetSuite at my last startup, it used to take us a lot of time to pull the information reports that we needed for our quarterly investment meeting or the report that we wanted to send to both internal employees as well as stakeholders and shareholders at the end of the month. Upgrade to Oracle NetSuite today so you can get the visibility and control you need over your financials, HR, inventory, and everything you need in one place that you can access instantly. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/scale. Schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/scale. That is netsuite.com/scale.